2 Kings chapter 6, starting from verse 8. Yes. Are we all there? Now the king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, I will set up my camp in such and such a place. The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware of passing that place, because the Arameans are going down there. So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king, so that he was on his guard in such places. This enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel? None of us, my lord the king, said one of his officers, but Elisha the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. Go, find where he is, the king ordered, so that I can send men and capture him. The report came back, he is in Dothan. Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so that he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. As the enemy came down towards him, Elisha prayed to the Lord, strike these people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. Elisha told them, this is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man you are looking for. And he led them to Samaria. After they entered the city, Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men so that they can see. Then the Lord opened their eyes, and they looked, and there they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he asked Elisha, shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them? Do not kill them, he answered. Would you kill men you have captured with your own sword or bow? Set food and water before them so that they may eat and drink and then go back to their master. So he prepared a great feast for them. And after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away and they returned to their master. So the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory.
I was glad that Catherine read the right passage. Otherwise, we might have had to do a sermon on the spot. I once went to a church to share about some of the work we were doing. And I'm stood at the back near the sound guy. And I just got this strong sense at the start of the service that somebody had actually thought I was coming to preach the sermon. And I turned to the sound guy and said, you are certain it's not me? He went, Ian, nothing to worry about. And then the guy who was leading the service stood up and said, and just before Ian brings the word, and I looked at the sound guy and went, and so on the spot, I was like, oh, please God. But what we are looking at is this morning is at 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 8 to 23. And just to kind of follow on a little bit, I mean, some of you had the great joy and fun of coming yesterday to the walk through the Bible, the Old Testament. And if you weren't able to get to that yesterday, I'd heard about it before, and actually came along to actually see what it was like. And it was fantastic. And I will be making some references. So if some of you suddenly wonder why I might do stuff like this, and I want you to tell me what these are. I'm not doing any more. I need a lot more time to practice than that. So the rest of you are probably sitting there going, they have lost the plot. We have, but it was good fun. And so I will do a couple of actions to see if you actually know what I'm talking about, just to make sure you're still awake. But what I also want to just share to start with a story that kind of, I think, picks up on the theme that we're going to be looking at. In July 1997, I went for a second time on a visa team to St. Louis in Missouri, working with the Lighthouse Free Methodist Church in downtown St. Louis. Now, the first time that we went, they didn't tell us what this area was like until we got on the plane. And they said that this area of St. Louis had a higher murder rate than the whole of the United Kingdom and Canada put together in a year. And that first instance when we went, I was like, God, what am I doing here? Why have you sent me to America, which is somewhere that I always thought I wanted to go, but now was in an area where we thought we were hearing fireworks at night, and they were saying to us, oh no, that's gunshots. And we were literally, you know, it was an mainly black neighborhood. So, you know, Muggins here, at 6'9", white and English, sticks out like a sore thumb. And, you know, they even, some mornings you get up, you put, a certain color t-shirt on, and they go, sorry, Ian, you can't wear that, because if you wear that outside and a gang wearing another color comes past, they might shoot you. Oh, thanks. And so, but God did amazing things through that first trip. And so I went back with Joanna a second time. And on this second, what we would do with these kids, about 150 kids, is we'd get all these big yellow school buses and we take them on a trip. And this one particular place we're going to was a place called Merrimack Caverns. And it's about 50 miles south. Hold on, I'm going to get my bearings. Okay, to put it into context yesterday, St. Louis is here. Merrimack Caverns are down there. Okay? That picture's not come out very well. But what the amazing thing about Merrimack Caverns is, there's an actual cavern that is literally about the size of this room. And they actually hold concerts in here, and they have a whole light display. It's also, just to give you a bit of history, apparently one of Jesse James's hideouts. And they actually have this little hut, because, you know, he would have built a hut in the middle of a cave. They actually have this hut that goes, look, this is where Jesse hung out. It's like, okay, why would he build a hut inside? But never mind. Our guide is taking us round, and so some of these kids have never ever been outside of the city, let alone in a cave. And we get to a point, we're stood in this cave with these kids, and our guide goes, okay, I now want you all to hold hands, because we're going to switch all the lights off. Now, I was getting scared, never mind these kids, and so they're all standing around in this big circle. And she says, I'm going to count to three, and then the lights will go out. One, two, three. Absolute pitch and total darkness. Just like that slide, apart from the writing. Because you didn't see that at the top. And at first, there's a few squeals and stuff like that. Now, the thing we'd been teaching these kids is the whole thing of Jesus is the light of the world. Jesus is the light in the darkest of places. And at first these kids are all squealing and everything like that, and then suddenly, one by one, they started singing, Jesus is the light. Jesus is the light. Until it actually echoed round the cavern. And it's one of those experiences that I will take to my grave. The tingling and the sense of God being there in the darkest of places. When we now look at this story in 2 Kings, we read that Elisha and his servant are facing overwhelming odds. They, having been drawn into the politics of the region, Elisha has enraged the king of Aram, because no matter how the king tries to ambush the Israelites, Elisha knows every single one of his moves. Now, at this point, those of you who went through the walkthrough of the Bible yesterday, who can remember the whole thing of the kings? So we had the two territories, didn't we? We had for the rest of you. Okay. There came a time in the history of Israel, it was split into two. Okay? The number 19 represents the number of kings that Israel had in that time. And 20 is the number of kings that ruled Judah. Of all those kings, none of the kings of Israel followed God. And only 8 in Judah. What we're looking at now is a story where God is trying to bring back his people and the king into his plans. Because, as you start to read through the rest of the story, I'm loving this morning actually, where are they going to end up? See, people do listen. We're heading towards a point where the nation of Israel is going to be taken out. Oh, he's going to be, oh, actually, no, I see, it's going to be. I'm getting some really funny looks this morning from some of you people there going, they have lost the plot at Fullwood. Did anybody actually get a copy of the CCTV yesterday? Because that would be amazing stuff on YouTube. If you look round, it was like we all suddenly became charismatic in this church, people waving their hands around. Anyway, God is working in such a way in Elisha that Elisha is telling the king of Israel every single move that the king of Aram is making. The king of Aram believes that somebody in his own camp must be a spy and a traitor. Because there's no way the king of Israel can know the details. And his own officers say to him, but sir, it's that man Elisha who serves the king of Israel. It's as if he knows he's actually there with you in your own bedroom. It's almost as if he's a fly on the wall of your room, that he's actually sitting there and taking notes of what your plans are. Because God is wanting to bring back Israel into the right place with him. But the king of Israel is not getting it. And as we learnt yesterday through the walk through the Bible, none of the kings of Israel at that time worshipped God. And in fact, many times blasphemed his name rather than actually serve him. So the report comes back that Elisha is in Dothan, which is about 11 miles north of Samaria. And it's there on the map. So, again, coming back to yesterday, at the top we've got... Okay, so Dothan is about third row. Okay? Now then, Dothan in the Bible is only mentioned in one other place and concerns one other person. And I'm just going to do the action from yesterday. Andrew had to really think about this morning. He didn't get it at first. But who was this? You're so good. Dothan is the place where Joseph is betrayed by his brothers. Where they actually start out to kill him, but actually end up selling him off to the Egyptians. So he then has to go on this huge journey all the way down to... That was slower. That was a bit slower, folks. Keep up. And so, you could look at that situation and think, where was God in that? But God's plans and purposes are good. God's plan is always to bring his people back into a right relationship with him. And sometimes there may be the difficult times. And so when Elisha's servant wakes up in the morning, having seen all that Elisha has already done, either through, for the nation or for individual people, such as the widow in chapter 4, but it also shows that it's not Elisha who has the power, but God. Because even Elisha, at that point, when the widow comes to him, absolute despair, and his servant goes, what's the matter with her? And Elisha goes, I don't actually know, because the Lord has not given me the insight into what is taking place. And so Elisha acknowledges that whatever power he has isn't his. Whatever gift he has, it's not his, but God's. God is the one who gives and takes the power, not him. Okay? So Elisha's servant gets up in the morning, and, you know, the dawn's probably just breaking, and he looks out, hoping to see the hills. Because Dothan, as it describes, is at the head of a valley, and he's surrounded on most sides by hills. And surrounding their probably only escape route is this army and all these troops. There's horses, there's chariots. Now, at this point, my interpretation, I start placing characteristics on biblical characters. And every time I think of this servant, I think of Manuel from Fawlty Towers. I can't help it. Because it's just like, you know, if you ever saw the series, he goes, Signor Fawlty, Signor Fawlty. And he's like running around going, oh. That this is actually, you know, the servant's looking and going, I'm just loving how you're signing that, thank you. Oh, I make their life so hard work. But he's actually, you know, he looks at the problem and not at the one who can provide the solution. And so Elisha actually looks at it and he said, don't be afraid. Those that are with us are greater than those that are against us. Those that are with us are greater than those that are against us. Now, at this point, the servant must have been looking around going, well, there's me, there's you. I'm not seeing anybody else. Unless, you know, you've got them hiding in a tent somewhere. But this is a full-blown attack. This is horses, chariots, armed men. There's me, there's you, my Lord. And Elisha then says to him, Lord, or he prays, Lord, open his eyes so that he may see. And then I love this bit. The Lord then opens a servant's eyes and he sees on the hills surrounding them the army of the Lord. Do you know, I tried to find a picture of this is probably the best picture I could find to kind of express. If you're an artist, can you please, and you love doing like flaming animals and chariots, just as a side thing, I spent ages looking for a picture to kind of give you a glimpse of what it must have been like to actually see that sight. And all I found, the best picture I could find was a horse on fire. It's not a real horse, by the way, for those of you that love horses. Are we like Elisha, or are we like his servant? That when we face a situation that we think there's no escape from, where we face a problem that we know there's no way to get around it, do we start to go, oh, panic, like the servant, or do we put our trust in the God who can deliver us from all of that? Open your eyes so that you can see that those that are with you are greater than those that are with them. Because Elisha has the assurance that God is in control and that the army of the Lord is with them. But then the amazing thing is, now, you know, if I'd have been Elisha, I'd have been standing there going, right, fellas, bring it on. Look at my army. It's a lot better than yours. So as these, you know, the Arameans come forward and come into Dothan, and I'd have been doing, if I could whistle like this, my whistle's pathetic compared to Sue Chastney's, but there we go. She has an amazing whistle. Burst your eardrum if you're too close. You know, I'd have been whistling and went, right, army of the Lord, go do your thing. But he doesn't do that because that's not part of God's plan. God's plan is to bring the King of Israel and the nation back to him. Elisha says a prayer. Lord, strike them with blindness. And suddenly, this army that's coming in can't see him. Now, having studied theology, as I have, and as I was saying to somebody earlier, still don't get a lot of it, there's a lot of argument is, did the Lord strike them completely blind? If so, how could he then lead them 11 miles to Samaria without them getting upset? Or, as is often an affliction, especially among men, and especially among men of the Clarkson family, who have this very severe disease called object blindness, that in a state of stress and panic, no matter how hard I look for my keys in a room, I cannot see them. And then, obviously, God uses my lovely wife, Joanna, to walk into the room and go, but I looked there. They weren't there. And I don't know if you... I mean, it is a terrible, terrible condition. It's horrendous. But there is no... I don't think there's any cure, sadly. But God is in control of the situation. Okay? If God delivered your enemies into your hands, what would you do? If you were under attack, what would your response be? Because Elisha then leads these men. He says, I'm going to take you to the man you're looking for. And actually leads them right into the heart of Samaria. He places them literally at the feet of the king of Israel. And then their eyes are opened. And I bet they went, oops. They were sent out by the king of Aram to go and capture one man. That one man, through the power of God, delivers that entire army without even raising a sword or calling upon the army of the Lord into the hands of their enemy, into the hands of the ones they have been raiding for years and attacking. The king of Israel now has an excellent opportunity to show justice and mercy to his prisoners. And there were ways and rules you handle prisoners. So what do we read that the king of Israel turns round and says? Shall I kill them? Can I kill them? Because he's thinking about his status. He's thinking about how good he will look if he has, by his hand, slain his enemy. He's missing the point that God is in control of this situation. He's actually missing the point that God wants him to acknowledge who God is, that he is the Lord and ruler of all. And any power and authority he has is because God's given it to him. He completely misses the point. So Elisha then has to say to him, would you actually kill a prisoner of war who you had captured by your own sword and your own bow? You wouldn't. You would treat them justly and mercifully. Go and prepare them some food. And the king actually then, to his credit, prepares a great feast for them. And they then go back and for a time never raid Israel again.
But as you see later on in the passage, and as you read through the rest of 2 Kings, time and again, the king of Israel goes against God's plans. He curses. He thinks about number one. And sometimes doesn't even think about his people. Because he loses the sight that those that are with us are greater than those that are against us. See, because there has to be this balance between justice and mercy. Jesus taught us in Luke 6, "But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." And he's not saying as if you have to do that in your own strength. Because God will provide the strength and the mercy that you need. Love your enemies. Don't try and kill them. When the situation is bleak and everything and everyone seems to be against you, where do you place your trust? Hebrews 11 verse 1 says this: "Now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for." In God, who has more than enough resources and has already won the battle through Christ on the cross and by his resurrection, do you hold on to that in the bleakest of situations? The victory is already God's. The enemy is just trying to do some more damage. But those that are with us are greater than those that are against us. In 1 John 4 verse 4, it says this: "You, dear children, are from God and have overcome them, because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world." Just to think back to that story that I shared at the beginning. A group of children, fearful in absolute darkness, in a situation they have never experienced before. They're underground. It was fun while the lights were on, but now are in total and absolute darkness. And the first words that come out of their mouths are, "Jesus is the light. Jesus is the light." When you're going through the darkest of places, when you feel like there is no hope left, when you feel like all faith is gone, hold on to Jesus. Hold on to Jesus, because he is the light of the world. And though they were in the total darkness, their eyes had been opened, and they knew the power and the presence of God with them. Those little kids, who some of them had heard the gospel for the first time earlier that week, got it. Because they had the faith of a child. But they got it. That in the darkest of places, God is there with them. And if he's with us, who can stand against us? And my prayer as I close is that whatever situation you go through, you would open your eyes and see that God is right there with you through the power of the Holy Spirit, through the power of the cross and the resurrection. God has all the power. Who can stand against him?